I want to offer you a story that comes sort of next in line as we're journeying through the Bible this summer, looking at stories that aren't so well known, that maybe you have or haven't heard about or read about, but nonetheless have something amazing and beautiful to teach us. Our story today comes from the book of Numbers. Again, not a book that you crack open a whole lot. There's a few things that you might remember from the book of Numbers. But today we come to the 27th chapter of the book of Numbers, and a story that we might know of as the daughters of Zelophehad. You got to say that name with me real quick, because it's a tongue twister, and you look at it and you're like, what is that? So just say it with me. Zelophehad. All right, you're getting it. Practice a few more times and you'll have it down. The daughters of Zelophehad. So here we go. Look it with me in the first verse of chapter 27 in the book of Numbers. Then the daughters of Zelophehad came forward. Zelophehad was the son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, son of Joseph. A member of the Manassite clans. The names of his daughters were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, Eleazar, and the priests, the leaders, and all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And they said, "Our father died in the wilderness. He wasn't among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but instead he died for his own sin. And he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers." Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying this, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right in what they are saying. You shall indeed let them possess an inheritance among their father's brothers and pass the inheritance of their father on to them. You shall also say to the Israelites, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall pass his inheritance on to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. It shall be for the Israelites a statute and ordinance, as the Lord commanded Moses." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God this day. So a couple of laws and ordinances and commands are coming about in this story. And we're going to talk a little bit about those and what happens to them. But first, before we get started, what is a law? What is a law? Well, I went and looked up because I think there gets to be a lot of confusion about laws in our world today. And so I went to the dictionary. And it's interesting that when I looked up the word law in the dictionary, you get two basic meanings of that word. One is that it's a system of rules that a particular group of people, a community, a country, a church, that they recognize together as regulating the actions of their members. And you can enforce those through penalties or punishments. Or, I suppose, rewards, even. The second definition was a little bit different. And this sort of pointed me back to the world of science and math and physics, for example. That a law can also be a statement of fact. Something that we come to know through observation. Something, for example, from the natural world or a scientific world. A phenomenon that occurs always if certain conditions are present. A statement of fact. So, which of these two definitions, a system of rules or a statement of observable fact, are we speaking about when we look at the laws of Israel, the laws of the Hebrew people, God's people? Which do we mean? What about God's law or biblical law in general that we look at, that we talk about in our faith tradition? Do we mean a system of rules that govern or guide a particular community? Or are we talking about statements of fact that are observable and true in the world and don't change? I have a suspicion, and that's that Christians, that we sometimes get confused about whether God's law is a statement of fact that doesn't change, or whether it's a system of rules that guide a particular community at a particular time in a particular context. You see, there are scientific laws that are facts that don't change. They're immutable, if you will. Things like gravity. It's there. You can't do anything to change it unless you get off this earth into space. And then the laws of gravity they're still constant there. There's just not those forces that are putting gravity into place as much in space, right? Laws like cause and effect. Laws like Isaac Newton's infamous laws of physics. These things don't change. They're facts that go on and on forever. They're hard and fast rules by which the world moves and exists. You can't really challenge those laws. They simply are. You can observe them. You can describe them. You can name them. You can use them to your advantage. But there are also laws for people and groups of people. These laws are not immutable. They can change. They do change, in fact. They should change, particularly as knowledge increases, as technology changes, as people mature and grow, as communities expand, as context shifts and changes. Okay, so all that's a bunch of heady stuff. How about some practical examples for us to think about, right? Well, with my kids, I have a law about food in my car. It's really quite simple. No food. When Joy, Kate, and Nora were Lacey's age, when they were 2 and 3 and 4 years old, you see, they destroyed that little blue Kia that I get the privilege of driving all the time. Because we allowed them to have food in the car. There was no law against food. And so they had drinks and popcorn and goldfish and all sorts of other things. We even ate dinner in the car if we were in a rush or behind. And so then there came about spills, because 2 and 3 and 4 year olds aren't so great with holding their food and not dropping it or spilling. So that little blue Kia has more stains and spills and messes in it than I can clean up at this point in time. They just are there. So when we got our new C-Max a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I made a new rule. No food. Because I didn't want a car that was dirty and nasty that I couldn't clean up. Now, why did I make that law? Because one car had been destroyed, and I didn't want that to happen again with something brand new. Because the kids were still too young to be careful enough with food and drink in the car, and I needed something that would guide them to help them learn how to be more careful, or that would guide them until the point in life that they got in life that they could be more careful. So I also established that law because I wanted them to have some guidance about being clean and careful. Do we have food in the car today? Yeah, on occasion, when it's necessary because of time or travel. Will I keep this law of no food in my car forever with my kids? Probably not. As they grow up and learn and mature, the law will relax a little bit more. And it'll change because they'll be able to be more responsible and careful and clean. And in fact, if it doesn't ever change, I'm going to be the one that's going to feel the pain. Because right now, when I have my drink and they can't have theirs, it's really hard to help them understand how Daddy knows how to be careful. You don't. There's one law for me, there's a different law for them. That doesn't seem fair to them at this point. Will there always be an element of truth in trying to keep food and drink out of the car and off the floor and off the seats? Absolutely, the car is not the kitchen table. So here's the thing. Biblical laws are much more like my law about food in the car than the immutable and unchanging laws of science and physics. But Christians sometimes forget this. Or maybe we don't realize the difference in scientific laws and biblical laws. Let me give you an example. In ancient times, it was common practice to give extreme punishments for community crime. So if someone stole something, for example, in the ancient world, then you could cut off their hand for stealing as punishment for that crime. Well, in the Bible, God gives Moses some new laws that limit this pre-existing law that said you could take a hand for a theft. Those laws start in Exodus 20 with the Ten Commandments. And they go on and on and on. In fact, there's 630 some odd laws that are in the Old Testament that come at this time when Moses is first handed the Ten Commandments. Some of those laws limit violence in the community of Israel. They limit the violence of punishment in particular, so that in Exodus 21, verse 24, God lays out a law that scholars today call the Lex Talionis. You know it as this: an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Recall that one? That law limited the violence of punishment by essentially saying no longer can you take someone's hand just because they stole an apple. That's not an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The Lex Talionis law put into the Israelite society that the punishment must fit the crime. The punishment cannot be more harsh than the crime. No more could you take a hand for stealing an apple. God changes the law. But that's not the only time God changes this particular law. People grow, they develop, they mature. Culture changes, context changes. And so in the time of the Roman Empire, hundreds of years after the mountaintop Exodus story, a new law comes from God through the teachings of Jesus. And we read about that in Matthew 5, verse 38. It says this: "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn your other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile." This law completely changes things yet again. No longer can you be an eye for an eye, a tit for tat society. You cannot simply enact a punishment which fits the crime. Instead, you must walk the extra mile with someone who has done wrong so as to change their heart and behavior. This is a law that really is about rehabilitation, if you will. Turn your cheek was not simply submit yourself to get beat up again if you get beat up the first time. No, there was a point to turning your cheek. To slap someone on one cheek, you would use your main hand. And in Israel society, the main hand was a clean hand. To turn the other cheek is to force them to slap you with the other hand, with their left hand. And to slap someone with your left hand, which was the unclean hand in the Israelite world, because that was the hand that you did stuff with that wasn't clean. I'll let your imaginations take you to where why that hand might not be clean. To slap someone with that hand would have been shameful. It would have been an insult. It would have been forcing them to go the extra mile and damaging you in a way that would bring shame upon them. So to turn your other cheek was to call someone to account for the wrong that they had done to you. It was to up the ante, to call them out in a way that would bring shame upon them if they were to engage in that action. The goal was to point out the wrong that had been committed. If someone from the Roman military says to you, the citizen, "Get up, carry my stuff a mile down the road," then you were to point out the injustice of that act by walking a second mile and showing them the hurt, the harm, and the damage that it was doing to you. The goal was to change the heart and the habit of the person who committed the crime. The goal was rehabilitation. The goal was reconciliation. Why didn't Moses get that law back when he was on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments? Why did it come several hundred years later? Why did God change it at this point in time when Jesus came? I don't know that I have every answer for you there, except to say that there was a time in the world when an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was needed. It was needed to step in to help people grow and mature along the way of saying, look, when somebody steals an apple, you can't do something more harmful than that to them. That's wrong. It's injustice, immoral. It's unethical. And so God gave the law limiting violence to a certain degree. I would suggest to you that as people, the Israelites, grew in understanding of that law and practiced it and limited the amount of punishment and violence in their community, they got to a point where Christ comes and says, okay, you're ready for the next step. You're ready to grow and mature in your faith and your spirituality and your life and your practice in your relationships with one another. And now I want to teach you about how to use a punishment to rehabilitate someone. I want to show you the next step. Laws change and shift as people change and shift so that we grow and mature spiritually, physically, as a society. God's laws are not simply immutable. They change as people change, as communities change, as context changes. And that is exactly what we also see happening in the story of the daughters of Zelophehad. So let's go back there now. Laws had said at that time, prior to the daughters of Zelophehad, that property and possessions were inherited by sons, only by sons, not daughters. And if there were no sons, there was no inheritance. But the daughters of Zelophehad brought before the community during the time of Moses an instance where that law wasn't working because it wasn't providing for the ongoing longevity of a family who had no sons. These women, experiencing the effects of a law that wasn't working, that wasn't fair, that wasn't just, that wasn't ensuring the livelihood of their family, they courageously go to the tent of meeting. They speak up, they lift up their voices to the leader of the Israelites, Moses, not just to change things, but because they were trying to survive and get by in a world where their life was being threatened by not having enough. And what happens? The story tells us that Moses listens. Think about that for a minute. Moses, a man. A man for whom it wasn't necessary or in his interest to listen to these women. The law was working perfectly well for him and his folk. So he didn't need to listen. He didn't have a self-interest to listen to this person. But as a leader, he could have simply done what he thought was right. He could have held the tradition and enforced the current law of inheritance that had worked, from his perspective, perfectly fine for hundreds of years. He could have ignored these women. He could have done a lot of things, but Moses listens, and he takes this seemingly outrageous, crazy, progressive idea straight to God. And God listens. God changes the law. God actually says, you know what, Moses? These ladies are right. The law must change. So for people who want to pull out laws from the Bible and beat others over the head with them, they need to pay attention here. People bring a concern to the community. The community listens, shares the concern with God. God listens. In this story, God realizes that those people were right, and God changes the biblical law. And the truth is, that's really what any good leader does. Rules change as people change, and as needs change. And good leaders know this. good parents know this. Sometimes they realize the law needs to limit food. And as children grow, they realize that the law can relax a little bit as children grow and mature and become more responsible. In fact, good leaders know that the law must change if we are to continue to grow and develop maturely into good spiritual people with all the potential that God has made us to be. If a law simply said no forever with no rationale, we would never grow. We would never become all that God has made us to be. So I wonder, what is God calling us today to change? I wonder what people are out there right now, from every walk of life, from every political persuasion, from every church denomination, from every business, from every class, calling us to listen to something that's not working in their life, and then to take that to God in prayer, to listen for what God is saying to us, because someone's survival depends on it. And I wonder if we're listening to these people. Are we taking them seriously like Moses did? Do we simply hold to the tradition and the status quo? Or are we going to God in honest and authentic prayer? I wonder. And I wonder what God is saying to us in response to our prayers. Are we listening? Are we growing? Are we maturing? Are we developing ourselves so that the church, so that the people of God become all that God made us to be in the beginning? I wonder. Will you pray with me? Holy God, may we listen to you. May we lift our honest prayers to you. May we hear the voices of others from every walk of life in our world and come together, putting ourselves before the feet of your Son Jesus, lifting our burdens and our concerns to you. May we listen to your voice as you move amidst us, nudging us to grow into the people that you have created us to be. May your Son, Jesus Christ, save us all.